Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart. A very big welcome to Books and Arts here on RN, on your ABC radio app, or however you like to listen. Today, it's all about the performing arts. We visit a risky new theatrical experiment that brings us real people looking for real work in an unrehearsed stage performance.
The question is, can we make a work in front of an audience with people that are completely unprepared off the street? And that's an interesting artistic exploration to go through.
And ancestral spirits take over frenzied dancers in a new collaboration based on the Indian ritual Kuda Lumping. But first, here's a good way to showcase new Australian plays. You hold a festival. All my people on the flight past stand and speak. Whether you walk the boat or you walk on beats, fly far as your wings will reach. Me and my paper plane keep fighting on the winds of belief. Mantra by one of Australia's leading hip-hop artists with Flight Path. And, well, as you know, one of my great passions is Australian art, especially new Australian theatre. And Melbourne's Theatre Works have been making Australian theatre for decades. And now they bring us Flight, a festival of new writing, which showcases new plays by five Australian playwrights. Raimondo Cortese is one of the people behind this program. He's a theatre writer, he's a dramaturg, he's a director, a man about town. He teaches at the Victorian College of the Arts. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Nice to be talking to you again after so long. We haven't
eyeballed
each other for ages. So this is a collaboration between the VCA, the Victorian College of the Arts, and the theatre company Theatre Works. How does this work, this collaboration?
And also Footscray Community Arts Centre, I should mention as well. Essentially, I think a bunch of writers who are graduates from the VCA writing program, which started in 2012, submitted their works to be produced by Theatre Works as part of their independent program. And Dan Clark, the AD there, had this great idea that why not, you know, umbrella them in a festival context, so put them all together and create a new platform for them.
So these are your students,
Well, ex-students, yeah. And so the VCA Writing for Performance course has been going, it's in its fourth year now. And so everyone in this festival have graduated from that course, either Chivu in 2012 and the others in 2013.
All right. So one of the plays is called Dead Twin. It's written by Chivu, who joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Nice to be talking to you again. You and I first met, I don't know, 15 years ago, I think it was. But you and I have been talking to each other for a long, long time.
Yeah.
So this show's called Dead Twin. Oh, and the director is Deborah Lisa Moore.
Hello.
Welcome. And you also perform in this play.
I do. It's a bit of a challenge, yeah. A new challenge, directing and performing.
Yeah, you've got to be everywhere at once. So you better tell us what the play's about.
Okay, so the play's about Steve, who has a really bright future, and his parents don't want to tell him about what's happened in the past because they don't want to harm him. So it's a protective thing that they're doing, but he feels like he's incomplete unless he knows who his dead twin is.
So he's got a dead twin.
He's got a dead twin.
And when you say they don't know what's happened in the past, what do you mean? What is this past of which we speak?
Yeah, there are hints of the family having been through war, but the piece draws on the subconscious. So it's in a horror genre and it's dreamlike. So it's not necessarily linear or like a Hollywood teen horror. There's references to war and moving house and, you know, the dead twin being angry.
Right. And is this referencing the Vietnam War? Is that in your...
I guess for this piece, I wanted to make it a much more meta piece. So the family is not a Vietnamese family. In fact, we have a colorblind cast for the dead twin, and it's there's just a reference to a war in the past,
right,
rather than specifically the Vietnam War.
Colorblind, just to explain to people who haven't heard the term before, means that you cast people with no regard to the race of the actor or the ethnic origin. Race is the wrong term. The ethnic origin of the actor.
Yeah.
Just mix them all up.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, opera does it successfully, and we'd like to do it too.
Of course, absolutely. Well, Australia's like that anyway. That's how we all are.
We do have mixed families.
We do. We all have mixed families, yeah. So this is a fantastic combination. So, Deborah,
you have a Jewish heritage.
That's right, yeah.
So what are you bringing to the table here? Because is there some overlap in your experience?
Well, absolutely, and that was what Chi and I really found in common from the beginning. A lot of my own work has to do with my history of coming from a European Holocaust history and how that has really invaded me, or how that trauma has been a huge part of my life from, you know, day one, basically. And my work, which I've done a lot of solo work until now, really deals with that using my theatrical style, which is very physical, very visual.
So the term inherited trauma, I heard the other day on a Radio National program, on an RN program, is that a concept that makes sense to you?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. We've sort of been looking at this academic named Marion Hirsch, who writes all about that. But absolutely, I mean, we look at the thing of, like, the trauma, really, it's in your body, it's in your brain, it's in your dreams. I mean, I used to have nightmares, really, pretty much every day about...
Implanted in you how?
Through the silence, really. Through a lot of silence, through a lot of what I read, through what we were brought up with.
Let's talk about silence first. You mean the silence of your own family life?
Absolutely, absolutely. So my father came, he never really talked about it. So in a way, I had to dream and learn about my lost dead family, and that's what I did. I dreamt them, I imagined them, I reconstructed them in my life and in my dreams / nightmares, and then basically in my theatrical work. And the dead twin and Chi and I really have a common history in that way, where we both, I think, live with the trauma of our inherited past.
Is silence affected too for you, Chi, or did your relations talk about the war and what they'd been through?
Mixed, I think. I mean, you don't know what you don't know, obviously. But even things like, experiences that I was part of, there's no reason for them not to talk about it. But we just don't talk about it because daily family life is about, you know, getting food, you know, eating, getting to places, etc.
But there's also a view that it's just better to move on.
Exactly.
I mean, and there is something in that. If you just mull on the past all the time, you'll never live in the present.
However, well, could I just, well, I think that's yes and no. It's interesting. I think we come to a place like Australia where it's so wonderful. You don't have all these traumas here. I mean, it's such an incredibly, I guess, the old-fashioned lucky country if you come from other places. However, let's just get on with it, that kind of attitude. We don't really want to know. People still have those stories and histories and memories in them, and they have no outlet for them.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be glib about this. You understand what I'm saying, that
totally.
You can understand why there would be a view that perhaps in the family itself that we should move on.
Absolutely.
And why impose on the kids what we've been through? Here they are in Australia, they can have a fresh beginning.
And so if you give them the full detail of whatever painful, horrific events happened in the past, you might be traumatizing them. Australia does have this, all these stories that are untold that, are Aboriginal stories as well that, are silenced as well. So, I think it connects to many people.
And that's where the dead twin, really, that's why we chose to have this mixed heritage cast, I think, because everyone brings, it's like we all, people in this family, in the real cast, have their history that they're living with, their trauma, and even though they might come from different places, the living with the trauma is the same, I think, and that's what the dead twin really is dealing with, and that's why it's not one war.
This is Books and Arts on RN, and we're talking about a new festival of Australian plays, new Australian plays. Raimondo Cortese is the man behind it. He's the theatre director and dramaturg who teaches at the Victorian College of the Arts, and with us are theatre makers Deborah Lisa Moore and the writer Chi Vu. So there's a rich play. Tell us about the others. Are there thematic links, continuities with the other four plays you've got in this series?
I think that people sort of tap into the zeitgeist, and I think this issue of silence, repression, the inability to talk about loss, I think is a key thing in all of them. Kindness, certainly you have a kind of bunch of office workers who are dissatisfied with their lives and they kind of live through these kind of frustrations and silences, the things they don't talk about. Virgins and Cowboys is kind of... very post-traumatic, quite a bizarre, nutty play. But I think, again, it deals with a kind of what people's repressed desire.
Now hang on, Chivu's laughing here. Have you seen this?
Not for a while, not since VCA, but, you know, the premise is, yeah.
Well, the premise is that two guys, well, a guy gets on the net and wants to, you know, have sex with a virgin, and I don't think that he's so successful, is he? But anyway, that's the kind of premise. It's kind of a silly one in a way, but it actually opens up something very interesting dealing with, you know, the sexuality and repressed desire and all the rest of it. Grief and the Lullaby is, by the, you know, as you can tell by the title, is very much about dealing with loss. And I just think it's really interesting in this country, because I always think, you know, we have incredible cultural amnesia, and all this thing around so many people come here and have fled violence, fled famine, fled war. I mean, we're populated by people who have actually fled trauma. And you know, we don't talk about the Aboriginal genocide. We don't talk about...
Well, we do. I mean, more and more
we're starting to now.
Yeah, more and more we do.
Yeah, but look what happens to Adam Goods. He does a war cry and people boo him, which of course means but the silent other, majority...
And support him. It was just
they're not so silent.
Not so silent now.
What it shows is that in Australia there is a great conversation between those who are tolerant and welcoming and those who are less welcoming and, you know, have other values.
Yes. You're absolutely right.
And in the end, what has happened is there's been this great, as he says himself, this great outpouring of love. Mm. Yeah. I mean, we shouldn't underestimate the power of Australia to heal, the power of Australia to welcome, the power of Australia to embrace.
I agree. I mean, we can see that with what just happened, but also I think with, you know, theatre and look at all these pieces and the fact that we can actually speak and can actually talk about these things through our, you know, whether it's theatre, whether it's sports, we are in a country that we can do that. And
it's
we
always been a conversation between those who welcome and those who say, no, that's enough.
Yeah.
I agree. I do think that we kind of hide behind a kind of laissez-faire, easygoing kind of mythology a bit, though, and that when people, you know, put their hand up and say, well, actually, that's not my experience, they tend to get stamped on. And you're right. I think the vast majority of people we don't have the skills to actually go, well, hang on a minute, that's not acceptable, or not the skills. We're not culturally used to getting on the front foot in the way, you know, like, you know, if it was Italy, you just would erupt into an argument straight away. Australians tend to sit back a little bit, and that's fine. And I absolutely agree with you, because I actually think that we are a very welcoming country, and in a lot of ways, and we're very accepting of different cultures in a way that, I mean, we don't have a clear national identity, for one thing. We are a multicultural entity.
Well, maybe that's the clear national identity.
Well, but we're still talking about it, though, aren't we?
Yeah, but it's a work in progress.
Yeah, it always will be, yeah.
I'm very optimistic, you see. I'm optimistic that the welcoming side of Australia, the ability to integrate and build a country that... Look, I had an experience the other day. I was in Kalgoorlie. In fact, I was there for the Regional Arts Conference, and I was picked up by a guy who was African. And I thought, wow, this guy's a long way from home. And he was from Somalia. And I said, what brings you to Kalgoorlie? He said, well, it looks a bit like my own country. But basically, I've come to paradise. Mm. You know, I've lived in a country all my life where I've been afraid, and now I'm in a country where I'm welcomed. I am in paradise.
Yeah, that's right.
It was the most moving thing
that's
I'd heard in my life.
That's
A Somali taxi driver thinks that driving a taxi in Kalgoorlie is paradise.
Yeah, I did some interviews for another piece of mine with some ex-soldiers, and in particular, what struck me with this young boy from Burundi who had this, oh my God, incredible story as a child soldier, loss of family, and he is so happy here. However, he goes, I said to him, where, you know, what is your ideal? He goes, I love it here, but I'd love to live back home as it is here.
Yeah.
That's the ideal. And I think that's quite touching and quite, you know, but so happy, so lucky. I mean, my father, I mean, God, you know, he was so lucky to come here, so happy, and he always appreciated it. Yeah. Different times then, of course, but, you know. Yeah. Maybe
well, this is a rich conversation, Raimondo, and what it shows is that when you put on Australian plays, they address Australian voices, they do Australian stories in Australian voices, which, as you know, is my cause. The reason I think I'm on the planet is to campaign for this. Well, as you've been teaching, as we wind up, as you've been teaching young and aspiring Australian playwrights, do you find that more and more of them are looking for Australian stories, or you know, what's the mix, do you think?
Well, I think it's kind of matured in the sense that I haven't mentioned Yours the Face too, which is a wonderful monologue about modelling and the kind of the dark side of it and also dealing with obsession, which is I should have mentioned that before. But yeah, look, I think that, you know, in this course, people are basically encouraged to find and discover their own voice. And that means not just in terms of thematic interests, but also aesthetic voice, the kind of form that they might choose, and really sort of personalise the work. And I think when you do that, you kind of discover very interesting things. You're not trying to sort of think about, which I think Melbourne Theatre is very good at, we're not trying to sort of say, well, if you write in this particular way, you can market your work better. It's really about, Melbourne's a very accepting community in terms of, looking at different forms and different styles of work. So if you find your voice, you'll find an audience for it. And in fact, you'll find probably more an audience will more readily engage with something that's honest. So I think that really I think when we talk about Australian story, what's interesting is that, like, Virgins and Cowboys, I mean, this is a person who's, she's actually born in America and has lived here for about several years. And it's really interesting for her, for example, because the content is actually on the surface quite American, and yet it seems to fit in to our culture quite readily.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think it's very, very, very hard to define what Australian is.
Well, we've had a good crack at it just then. What a nourishing conversation. Thank you to all three of you for coming in.
Thank you.
It's been great to meet you all again. Raimondo Cortese is a theatre director and teacher. The playwright we met this morning is Chi Vu, and with her director and performance artist, Deborah Lisa Brown. So the festival's called Flight. It's 5 new Australian plays. It's on at Theatre Works, which is in St Kilda, and also around the Footscray Community Arts Centre, the very vigorous Footscray Community Arts Centre, through most of August. And you'll find all the details that you need on the Books and Art homepage. There's a link there to the website where everything is explained. On RN, this is Books and Arts. Well, the ALP and Greens-backed Senate inquiry into arts funding gets underway in Melbourne today. The inquiry will be looking, among other things, at ongoing cuts to arts funding and the reallocation of $105 million from the Australia Council. This is by the Arts Minister, George Brandis, who's reallocating the money from the Australia Council to his new body, his new funding body, the National Program for Excellence in the Arts. So far, this Senate inquiry has received over 2,000 submissions, and there will be 5 hearings all up. And a large section of the arts community has expressed the view that these changes to the Australia Council add up to disaster, and talk about the way in which the viability of the arts is in threat. The Minister responds that his critics are wrong, that they are against... new avenues of funding are a good thing, and he says that his critics are just afraid of change. Independent artist David Pledger is the director of Not Yet It's Difficult. He's a big name in cutting-edge performance all over the world. He's a real player, and he will appear at the Senate hearings today, and he joins us right now. Hi, David.
Hey. How are you going, Michael?
I'm terribly well. Now, what do you say to the Arts Minister who says that people like you who don't want to see the National Program for Excellence are just afraid of change?
Well, for me in particular, the change means that I am severely disabled in my ability to find money for my work. So it's for example, some change is good, some change is not. If you can get by on 2 glasses of water a day and that's all you've got in front of you, and somebody takes one of those glasses of water away, can you get by on 1 glass of water?
But, David, how do you know that you're not in the running? I mean, the Minister says that he's there to promote excellence. You clearly have runs in the board. I mean, Not Yet It's Difficult, your company, has performed all over the world. Maybe this is the very kind of excellence he has in mind.
That'd be great, except that as an individual artist, I'm actually exempt. I'm not able to apply according to the guidelines of the NTEA. Individual artists are not allowed to apply. So... even if I am excellent, it's certainly not the kind of excellence that the Arts Minister values.
Well, let's talk about your deeper worries, because you're not just arguing on your own. Are we still with you, David?
Yes, I'm here.
You're not just arguing on your own account. You say that there's a misunderstanding about the relationship between the major theatre companies and what we might call the alternative, or the medium size, the small to medium sector. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's often a lot of ways to describe the relationship. Some people call it, some people say that the small and medium and independents are a feeder for the major organisations. Some say that there's an interdependency. I'd probably describe it more as a symbiosis, and that as one does well, the other tends to do well. But if one doesn't do well, the other probably doesn't tend to do well.
Because, David, we often talk as though the small to medium sector is the kind of training ground for the big companies.
We do, but I think it's probably more accurate to say that there's two separate ecologies and that they sit side by side. I think that, for example, the independent small to medium sector can do just as well if the major organisations, that sort of larger sector, were not around. I don't think that they would be fundamentally affected. There would be issues of visibility about culture and discussions around that space. But in terms of actually making work and being able to have a job, I don't think that would change. I think for the majors, however, they do get quite a lot of flow from the sector. For an independent artist may work with a major organisation, they'll make their own work and they'll tour their work overseas. So the sort of portfolio of activities are quite varied. But very importantly for the majors, when those independent artists do go in and work for the major organisations, whether it's a state theatre company or an orchestra or the Opera Australia, what actually happens is they bring all of the ideas and the new experiences they've had being an artist out in the world and outside of those institutionalised formats, and they invigorate and they test and they challenge what's going on in those traditional institutions. And that, I think, needs to be really valued, not just in terms of the broader cultural sector, but from those major organisations.
Now, what is it that makes you think that the minister won't support companies that have that ambition, that idea to test the orthodoxies, to challenge the orthodoxies?
Well, okay, so for example, 4 or 5 years ago, I relocated to Brussels and I set up a program between the Australia Council for the Arts and the International Network for Contemporary Performing Arts. I can tell you unequivocally that the most excellent artists, the ones that are mentioned, the ones that are going out and testing the waters already, are those artists that come from the independent sector. It was very rare to have any conversations in which any of the major organisations came up. I'm not suggesting that it's not their, right and their privilege and their sort of an important thing for them to test the waters, but it shouldn't be done at the expense of those people much further down the track in that space, which is the small to medium sector and the independent artists.
Now, I've read the letter that you wrote to the Senate inquiry ahead of your appearance today before the inquiry. So some of the issues that you want to raise with them are peer assessment. Do you think there is a value to peer assessment under the Australia Council, a dimension that obviously is missing from the new program? What's the problem with doing things differently at the program?
Look, I think it's a really good question. It's a very important question. It's been unpacked quite a lot. What peer assessment is probably the best model. No, peer assessment is the best model that we've got. It's not perfect. And, it's flawed and, it's inevitable that certain, decisions maybe don't reflect the quality of the applications. But I'm somebody who has, I think I've probably got the longest record for unsuccessful applications to the Australia Council, which was all through the 90s. I think over 9 years I put in applications and I didn't get a Guernsey at all. And then in the next 10 years I was more successful. At some point along the way, I think you have to say, well, look, we're humans, we're flawed, we're going to make mistakes. There's so many things that we actually have to deal with and think about in terms of making these decisions. It's better to have that set of problems than it is to have the set of problems in which government directly makes decisions about artists and their activities, because independence is absolutely crucial, not just to the art sector, but to the health of a democracy. And I think that's really the space that we're talking in at the moment.
So you're suggesting that a ministry that makes these decisions will bring political values to bear, are you?
I think that's undoubtedly the case. It's almost impossible for that reflex not to be engaged. The other thing I think that's really kind of worthwhile thinking about is just, best practice. So, for example, I follow footy. Peter Gordon's the chair of the Western Bulldogs Football Club. He leaves it up to his coaching staff to select the team every Saturday. He's a lawyer. He's not somebody who's got, experience as a football player and, long-term sports administration. He lets those decisions to be made by those people that have the knowledge and the expertise. When you take that away, it inevitably complicates the situation. Other agendas come into play, and it leaves the whole process open to questions of transparency. And I think for the arts, because, you know, the arts is really, artists, their job description is that they have to challenge and they have to, you know, provoke, and they have to offer alternative ways of thinking. If a minister is making those decisions, then in most ways I would think it would be very difficult not to be simply a projection of that person's taste. And I think that is the great fear, and probably there are so many exceptions along the way where that's happened elsewhere.
Well, David Pledger, thank you for giving us a little preview of what you're about to say to the Senate inquiry into arts funding today in Melbourne.
My pleasure, Michael. Nice to speak to you. Cheers.
Independent artist and curator David Pledger. He runs Not Yet It's Difficult. He's the director of that very important company. And he's speaking today before the Senate inquiry into arts funding. That kicks off today, actually, in Melbourne. Across Australia, this is RN. You're listening to Books and Arts.
In bed by 10, up all night, shift worker, dancing till dawn, or listening to Philip Adams. What's your take on the theme, Up Late? Tell us, and you could be off to the Melbourne Writers' Festival. RN and the festival are giving you the chance to win a spectacular prize pack, flights and accommodation included, and the opportunity to join Michael Cathcart at the festival's opening night. Just look for Up Late on the RN homepage.
Now, on Friday evening, Melbourne's Arts Centre will be really jumping the dance and musical troupe. Oh, I don't know how to say it. How do we say it, Gideon?
Kudalumping.
Kudalumping. No, the name of the company. There we have got it. They're performing the ritual, which is known as Kudalumping. It's a traditional ceremony in which dancers enter a frenzied state. Their bodies are taken over by spirits. Now, this is the first time this has been performed in Australia, been performed outside Indonesia, I think. And Gideon Obajanek, the Australian choreographer, has teamed up with dancers. He's directing the performance. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for helping me out with the pronunciation. I didn't practice it ahead of time. And the Indonesian musician Ruli Shabara is with us
correct.
As well. So the dance is called what?
Padepokan Gunungkers, the name of the troupe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the troupe. And then the dance is called Kudalumping. So what is it? What is this dance?
Kudalumping is an ancient dance where back when they... ancient Javanese, where they all perform a dance as an entertainment for the people instead of the royal families or the people who have all the access to the good music like gamelan. So this performance is for the people, where they gather all the people in the big big hall or big where the people can meet, and then they perform this. This raw dance with raw instruments.
And is it an entertainment or is it a religious
Initially
event?
It's an entertainment, but and then it's mixed with the local beliefs, where they have to perform rituals and, you know, beforehand. And so the people will be possessed. And that is an entertainment for people.
Oh, people are possessed. So they really are in a frenzy. I mean, I've seen some film of this. People are just...
Mm. Yeah. So originally the dance is like a warrior dance, and it's performed... It's a folk dance rather than a court dance. So it's a sort of a dance of the people, as Ruli was saying. But there's a whole process of ritual, prayer and offerings the day before, and a communion with the spirits of the dead to... partake in this performance. And so I think, as Pakiswandi described it, the shaman that we're working with, there's a door that's opened through this performance to the world of the dead, and through this door the dead enter, and they enter the bodies of the young men who are dancing. And so there's this period of time where both the living and the dead are together, and then they are asked to leave, or sometimes they're forced to leave, exercised at sort of towards the end of the show.
of a show. It's interesting. I don't have the cultural categories really to place this.
I was really quite concerned about the idea initially about taking something traditional out of its original setting, like
a
clearing
in the
village.
That's the question, isn't it? What happens when you take something out of the village where it's got this? I mean, obviously sits very comfortably in the life of the village, and you put it on stage at something called an art centre.
Mm. Absolutely.
What happens to it, Gideon?
Well, what happens to it is that it is what it is. They do pretty much exactly the same thing, but rather than try to recreate that environment, which is absolutely impossible, I discussed with a group about...
Now you'd need chickens and...
Mm. And people on mobile phones and mopeds and street vendors and families and grandmothers and little children. Yeah. But here we've put it into this very almost neutral space, like a white space, the floor, the screens. Mm. And with Ben Cisterne, the lighting designer, we're taking the sound from the quite large music group with percussion and gamelan from their microphones, from their instruments, and then we're processing that and... programming the lighting that the work exists in to reflect what the music sounds, to look at what the music sounds like. So it, as the group goes into trance, the whole space shifts psychologically, and we're actually closing the State Theatre stage and inviting all the audience to be up on the stage, which is huge, with the performers.
Oh, so there's no one in the seats?
There's no one in the seats.
So can you see the seats, or are you dropping a curtain?
We're dropping... a scrim probably about 1.5 to 2 metres above the deck. So you can see the full auditorium, but it's actually the screens around the performance that will be the main thing.
I'm betting that was a health and safety nightmare getting that through. How did you negotiate that?
Well, we started early, and I believe that we're ushering the audience, rather than through the auditorium, we're actually ushering through backstage. So people are actually entering the State Theatre. And for most people, it'll be the first time they'll be on the State Theatre stage actually looking out on 2000.
And it's so exciting. Every time I go backstage, every time I enter the building, any theatre actually, through the stage door and go through all the stuff at the back, it's always exciting, even though... it's not grand. When you go backstage, it's never grand, is it? The front is all sort of glitzy and carpet, and out the back, they don't bother to line the walls. There's pipes everywhere.
Smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, it's absolutely so candid. So what happened? How did you two come together to be working on this, really?
Gideon was working with Volcanic Winds, which is a producer in Indonesia. It's Christy Monfrey's company in Indonesia, where they contacted us, me and my friend, to search for the proper a group for him to bring over here. And then after seeing a few groups, then we decided to take this one because this seemed really, really real, and they know what they're doing, and I think they're capable of performing that here. Yeah, even though there are some obstacles, like, for example, they needed to, sacrifice live animals or other all those things that I think is impossible to do it here.
Yes, but that would be tricky.
Yeah, and they're still able to do it without doing all these other things.
Right. Well, yeah. Now, you explained that it has this spiritual dimension. Forgive me for not understanding this, but my understanding is that most of Indonesia is a Muslim country. This is not part of Islam, though, is it? This is what's the religious background for this?
Animism. Right. Before Islam, this is the original, I think, the original belief of most Indonesian people, animism, even before Hindu. Before animism, Hindu and then Islam.
So does this imply that Indonesian people have a kind of complex religion that's got many elements in it?
It is a Muslim country in the sense of the number of people, so most of them are Muslim, but it is not a Muslim country. You know, so the beliefs is beliefs and religion are different things. So belief are the like moral values, the family values that people apply on their daily life, which is some aspect like from their religion or from experience, or so it's not like, for example, other Muslim countries where they apply the moral based solely on their religions, but this is entirely the religion is just part of their life.
This is a fantastic distinction, isn't it, between your beliefs and your religion?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, Indonesia is a religious country, but there are many religions there, and Islam is the main religion of the country. But as you go into the villages, you realize that it's actually a strange cocktail of different belief systems that somehow coexist quite harmoniously.
Yes.
Right. So the troupe itself, who were they?
They're the leaders, Islam, and the troupe, the members, they, some of them are Christians, some of them are Hindus.
But they all
Buddhist.
Come from the one village, do they?
Yes, yes. But they're today they're bringing some other members from other villages.
Right.
Yeah, but still
close,
under...
Close by.
Yeah, close by.
They've got some friends they thought would they'd bring in as well.
Yeah.
Now, Gideon, what's this done to your head? Gideon Obojanic, O creator of contemporary dance.
Well, you know, well, one thing was that I was concerned that this would be a kind of an uncomfortable spectacle of watching some kind of religious or animistic ritual ceremony. And when I went to Indonesia, I was very relieved and delighted to see that actually it is a spectacle and it is a performance and it is a ritual. So it's all of those things. And I became much more comfortable about it. I began dance doing, as a child, doing Israeli folk dancing. So and I somehow forgot about that. My initial entree into dance was folk dancing. And I would say in the last few years, I've become more interested in folk dancing. And this is a very, you know, specific and extreme departure from the folk dancing that I'm familiar with. But Indonesia is always...
It doesn't feel like the kind of folk dancing you're going to put on at the local primary school.
No, it's not. Mm. But look, I've worked with Robin Fox and a number of other people with video interactivity and synesthesia and this idea of shifting people's perception in my own performances with Chunky Move. And this, I think, unique relationship works really well, particularly in the context of this Super Sense Festival, the Festival of the Ecstatic, because we have a combination like this, a very ancient form of ecstasy, really, you know, butting up against
We haven't
German,
explained this.
German techno.
Yeah, this event is part of a bigger festival called the Super Sense Festival. Mm. So, I'm sorry, do go on, yes.
Well, when thinking about Super Sense, and I wasn't involved in the whole making of it, but in this part of it, I think what's been really important for me was to look at ecstatic practice that has been going on for a very long time, and how can it collaborate with new forms of perception shift. And so I think this is a really interesting collaboration, not only between Indonesia and Australia, but between the ancient and the highly digital technical present.
And a highly emotional work, I'm imagining.
It is extraordinarily beautiful. I mean, often people, when they speak about Kuala Lumping, they talk about the very disturbing nature of it, where people perform feats of superhuman strength when they're entranced to prove their immortality.
So it's immensely dynamic, isn't it? There's a lot of swirling and
there's a lot,
twisting. And
yeah, and by the end of the performance, there's stuff everywhere. Mm. It's a total mess because they are, you know, doing things like taking roof tiles and smashing it over their bodies with hammers and doing, you know, quite disturbing things. But that's all mixed with incredible music.
It's so great you're involved in this. I mean, I think of you from Chunky Move as a creator of very clean lines, you know, contemporary dance with very clean lines and talking about bodies, almost as though there aren't people inside them, as though you're just moving bodies. And here we have people who are kind of ultra-inhabited, as it were, with stuff flying everywhere.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, actually, early Chunky Move was not that clean. You know, we were very interested in what happens in the energy of, you know, non-beauty and falling and careering. But when I watched this, I really didn't believe that half of these people will be alive the next day. And I'm so relieved that they are all here. It is extreme.
It does sound wonderfully exciting. Thank you to the two of you for coming in and telling us about it. So that's the Australian choreographer Gideon Obojanic, who's the director of the show. It's called Kuda Lumping, Ritual Dance from Indonesia, and it's being performed, is it just the once? Is it on the 7th of August?
One night only.
One night only, 7th of August, and it's part of this bigger festival, the Super Sense Festival, which is at the Arts Centre in Melbourne. And Ruli Shabara is one half of the Indonesian music duo Senyawa, and you're also performing in this festival as a musician.
Good.
You on Saturday?
Yeah, on Saturday.
On Saturday. So you can hear Ruli performing on Saturday as well. Anyway, there's a link to all the details you need from the festival. You can find about the musical events, the dance, everything. It's all there on our website. This is Books and Arts on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. Now let's continue testing the limits with a new production from one of Sydney's most innovative performing arts companies. There's no script to this show, not a script in the conventional sense, although there is a kind of a structure, and there are also no rehearsals. So this production's called Artwork, and it brings together a cast of untrained performers who are actually people who are looking for work. I mean, they're really looking for work. They've answered a job on the internet. Branch Nebula is the company staging this piece. It's at Carriage Works, the contemporary arts venue in inner Sydney. Daniel Browning is backstage for Books and Arts.
My name's Lee Wilson and I'm the co-creator of Branch Nebula.
And I'm Mirabelle Wouters of the other co-creator.
Artwork pushes the boundaries in the sense that we're kind of making an intervention into how the machine of going to the theatre works. You know, you as an audience, you have an expectation that you're going to go to the theatre and there's going to be professional actors on stage and you buy a ticket and so on. And this work is, we're actually setting up a situation. It's more of a situation than anything else, and the situation is really happening. So we have workers who are employed to be on stage, and what they're going through in moment to moment is really happening to them.
Yesterday at Woolworths, I stole a protein bar. Salvation Army store.
They don't know what's going to happen, and so they can only respond moment to moment, and that's what we're witnessing and experiencing as an audience.
So Mirabelle, I understand the, how do we call them, performers, the people who are going to be participating in the work. You found them in classified ads on the internet. How do you find these performers?
So we call them the workers. We put ads online and we don't really disclose at first instance anything about what they're going to be doing. So we just advertise for a research session, and which it just goes in with all the other research opportunities that are out there for people to go and participate in. And then once we have people responding, then we go into a conversation with them about what we're going to be doing. Yeah, but we don't meet up with them. So we don't actually meet them. We just have email contact beforehand. And the first time, the first time I meet them is actually after the show. But we have two people who work with them during the show who meet them like half an hour before they go on stage.
Now, Lee, you say the only certainty in this production is risk.
There's a lot of risk involved, that's for sure. It's a very nerve-wracking experience creating this work, but it's also, that's what makes it very exciting. The risks are to do with our workers and whether they're going to turn up to do the job. There's not the same kind of commitment you might make to a casual job. If you don't turn up, you'll lose that job. But a one-off job, there's a little less, you know, responsibility to turn up. So there's that aspect. And then the other aspect is how people are going to react to the various tasks and situations that we're creating for them to exist within. But having said that, we've been creating the work over a number of stages, and throughout those stages we have employed workers to come in on a regular basis, and so all of our decision making and everything is based on those practice sessions that we've had. And really for us, we're creating a structure that the workers slot into, and we're using a whole lot of devices. We have different ways of cueing and instructing the workers to carry out tasks. We use video capturing, so we're using live video feed which goes onto screens. And you know how if you're using a close-up of somebody's face, you can actually extract a kind of performance from them without them doing much, and it can be very interesting and engaging to have a close-up of someone's face. And we also use audio, so we will capture moments during the piece and then they get spat back out as samples later on, and creates a kind of accumulation of sounds and images that become kind of memories, you know, that come back. And when you juxtapose these different things, different elements, as an audience you start to form your own impressions without it being a linear experience, in the sense that what would be quite often expected in a work like this is that it's going to be biographical, and you're going to learn about who this person is, what's their name and what's their background. But rather than going down that quite typical and familiar path, we've chosen to develop an accumulation of images and impressions that you can draw your own conclusions about. You know, if we also have some standbys, workers that are sitting and watching, and if somebody decided at a certain point, oh, I don't want to be on stage anymore, I absolutely got to get out of here, then we'll replace that person with someone else. But this hasn't happened to date, and we've probably seen about maybe 300 workers already in our development process. There's a couple of things going on here. I think as an artistic experiment, the question is, can we make a work in front of an audience with people that are completely unprepared off the street? And that's an interesting artistic exploration to go through. And then in looking at that, it draws up a whole lot of other questions about our culture and our society and where the divisions are and how we sit. So it really, you know, on the one hand, we're exploring the act of looking and watching on stage, and that, you know, that's the license that you have, and how do you feel about that in this situation? And so, you know, the piece is a bit of a contemplation of, like, your position as an audience and the privilege that you have to buy a ticket. And we look at the workers who are there purely to get paid at the end. So that's why they're on stage. That's why they've arrived, and that's why we're looking at them. And so we can look at that and think about what that is.
Talk about this concept, Mirabelle, of street styles, which Branch Nebula seems to always... It seems to seek out a type of performer, the untrained, the non-actors, the real people. Talk about the street style in the work of Branch Nebula, and also in this work too.
This is something that has grown over the years as well, and so we have been, because of wanting to work with people who have those street style skills like skating and BMX and parkour, and they're experts in their field, but they're not performers, they're not trained as performers. And so over the years we have chosen to work with them to make shows and to somehow, you know, get a performance out of them, but that is their real self, who they are on stage. So we don't try to make them act, we just get people to be who they are on stage. And I find that so much more interesting to watch than someone pretending to be someone else. Yeah, so in that regard, that's kind of like another, like a continuation in the exploration of real people just being themselves in and going through this these tasks that they are set to do, and how they deal with that in front of an audience. And that's what's interesting, what decisions they make in that moment.
The thing that, for me and Mirabelle, we're always interested in non-verbal communication. That's why we make the kind of work we make, which is very physical and very visceral. And we're always looking for creating an experience that's happening in the now, that's non-representational. It's not a story about something that's happening somewhere else. What drives the work exactly is the audience's fear of the agency of those on stage. You know, like, how are they going with this? How are they coping with this? How do I feel about, you know, is this an exploitative situation? Is it okay for me to be looking at this? And that, all of that anxiety or fear kind of drives the work, and it does make it very dramatic and very high stakes, actually. And that's something we're very interested in. Whilst we're not putting on Shakespeare, you know, I appreciate the dramatic depths and levels of that kind of work. And we want to share with an audience that it's possible to have those kinds of levels of experience that's on par with that.
There seems to be some voyeuristic aspect to it. The audience doesn't know what to expect. The workers certainly don't know what to expect. There's a kind of voyeurism there.
I think any time you're sitting in the dark and there's a light on someone, that's a voyeuristic experience. But I wanted to add that all of the workers to date get invited to the show as audience. So some of the workers that we've had so far have been people who come from all walks of life, you know, and they are people that don't normally go to the theatre, but we're bringing them into this, we're forcing them to come into this situation, and it's really interesting to do that, that we can actually manipulate the structures that are available to us by using government funding, by having a prestigious presenter like Carriage Works that often present very big international names in this same venue, and we're manipulating all of these things in a very legal way to force something that hasn't been done before. And for me, the big challenge is about the form of this work, the kind of artistic territory, and it's to do with audiences' perceptions about what a performance can be, that we can build an engaging artwork with the audience, and they're implicated because part of this process is that they buy a ticket and they're implicated and they're a part of this. We can actually build an artwork with everyday people off the street, and I think that's a very interesting question. You know, can we do this right in front of you without any preparation?
Yes, it's certainly a risky premise for a show, and we love risky work here. That's Lee Wilson, co-creator with Mirabelle Wouters of the Sydney Theatre Group Branch Nebula. And the new production is called Artwork. It's on at Carriage Works in Everleigh in Inner Sydney from tonight. That's the 5th of August, Wednesday the 5th of August, until this coming Saturday the 8th of August. And you'll find details of all of that on our website. Now, as an RN listener, you have the opportunity to win a pretty specky prize. Flights for two people to Melbourne and free tickets for five events at the forthcoming Melbourne Writers Festival, including the big opening night events. And what we want you to do is to tell us in 100 words or fewer what the theme Up Late means to you. Maybe you like to walk at night. Maybe you're a truckie who often drives through the night. Doesn't matter. So in up to 100 words, dazzle us, surprise us, move us, make us laugh, whatever you like. And you'll find the details of how you do this at the bottom of the RN homepage, also on our homepage, actually, on the, the right-hand side. If you just look for the photo of the woman in black holding up a sign, you click on that and everything is there. That's how you register to be part of this. And you might be the winner, and I might see you at the Melbourne Writers' Festival, which kicks off on the 20th of August. So Bronwyn from Queensland had a crack at this. She writes about an unexpected visitor in her back garden. This is Bronwyn's 100 words or fewer. Moonlight flickers across the ground. Movement catches my eye. I can make out a shape, a pig. Must be young, it's small. Straining now to see into the gloom, I hear it, munching on grass, oblivious to its watcher. I must see it clearly, the torch, just a quick flash, and my mind explodes with pure joy. It can't be, it is, a wombat in Queensland, in my yard. Oh, it's just great to be up late. So thank you, Bronwyn, for that contribution, and if you'd like to have a crack at it, well, don't delay, just get in touch with us with your 100 words or less. 10 words would be enough. You might win the 10 words. Just up late, whatever it means to you. And you're an expert on up late because you're part of the wonderful group of people who listens to the show between the hours of 2 and 3 in the wee small hours, unlike all those other people, those conventional people who listen to us at 11 o'clock in the morning when we do the show for the first time. What can I tell you about the next show? Oh, now, you're going to meet the wonderful Sydney novelist Tegan Bennett Daylight, and she's decided not to write a novel this time. She's written a series of short stories all about the roller coaster of teenage life. And you'll also meet a really risky writer from England. And when I say risky, I really mean risky. This is a woman who likes to climb up on high roofs. There's an extraordinary photo of her in the English press on the roof of a college in Oxford, just teetering up there. Terrifying. Anyway, she writes books, or her latest book, anyway, is written on the rooftops of Paris. It's all about children who live among the rooftops, among the chimney pots there in Paris. That concludes the proceedings for this evening. It's been a real pleasure to spend this hour with you. Let's do it again tomorrow night. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Bye-bye.